The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Respiratory failure, ventilator therapy, and pulmonary function testing is presented by Dr. Thomas Morley.
I have no disclosures because I have no money. The first topic is kind of schizophrenic. We have a series of topics. We're going to talk about acute respiratory failure, some aspects of mechanical ventilation, and a little bit about some other topics as well. But my bread and butter, what I make a living at, is I talk about respiratory failure. And respiratory failure can be defined in all kinds of different ways. I'll talk about it in a second. But the respiratory failure is any time the respiratory system, and that includes the heart and the lungs, are not able to meet the metabolic requirements of the individual. And that is to say that everybody thinks that respiratory failure is when your lungs don't work. Well, that's not true. Your lungs can be perfectly fine, but you can be in respiratory failure for all kinds of other reasons. We'll talk about that. Now, there's all kinds of ways to define respiratory failure, and I outlined some of them here. Some of them are what you look for in textbooks, and the textbook information is really not that applicable to what we do on a daily basis clinically. For example, there's the anatomic etiologic classification, the physiologic etiologic classification, blood gases, that's what we do every day, hypercapnia and hypoxemia, that's how we make our living. X-rays, we'll talk more about that, black lung and white lung. And we'll talk a little bit about tissue oxygenation, which is the fundamental principle with respiratory failure. Now, this is the anatomic etiologic classification. We think of the respiratory structures as a chain, and that there's some break in the chain that leads to having respiratory failure. And it could be because the brain, the respiratory muscles, the lungs, the circulation, any break in that chain will cause respiratory failure. But the problem with that is that oftentimes when we see people clinically, we have no idea where the chain is broke. We don't know what the anatomic classification is. So that although useful in terms of physiology, it's not that useful clinically. Same thing with the physiologic etiologic classification. Respiratory failure can be because of inadequate respiratory muscle function, because of excessive respiratory workload, or the respiratory drive is inadequate for drug overdoses, whatever. But again, oftentimes when we see people in the ER, we have no idea what the cause of their respiratory failure is. More helpful clinically is this, and that is the blood gas classification. We do a blood gas on people or a pulse ox on people, and we find that they're hypoxemic. If we do a blood gas, we can find out they're hypercapnic. And by doing that, it helps us to find out what the cause of the respiratory failure is and also what we need to do to treat it. That is, if somebody's hypoxemic, we give them oxygen. We get their PO2 back up. If they're hypercapnic, we put them on BiPAP or ventilators, and we blow their CO2 down, and we get the respiratory failure better. Now, this is a simplistic slide, but in order for gas exchange to occur properly, you have to have a certain amount of ventilation that goes to the alveolus and a certain amount of blood flow that goes to the lung. And when that occurs properly, when there's equal amount of ventilation and equal amount of perfusion, gas exchange occurs normally, and we have somebody that's not in respiratory failure. On the other hand, you can have people that come in hypoxemic, where they're on supplemental oxygen, and they're still hypoxemic. So how do we know if gas exchange is inappropriate, whether it's not what it needs to be? Well, we can look at the alveolar arterial oxygen gradient. I apologize, a smidge of math, and then we'll move on. But you can calculate how much oxygen is in the alveolus. And if gas exchange is normal, the same amount of oxygen should be in the alveolus that's in the blood. So we can keep the equations there. The PA alveolar oxygen should be equal to the FiO2 times the barometric pressure minus water vapor pressure, subtracting from that the amount of CO2 that's in the alveolus. That's how much oxygen should be there. And we can calculate that easy at the bedside, or you can plug it into an app and it'll tell you. And then we measure the arterial oxygen, it should be equal to that. That's that if gas exchange is normal. If there's a big difference between the calculated alveolar oxygen and the measured arterial oxygen, something's wrong. That's the, we have to figure out what's wrong. And for people on room air, there shouldn't be any more than about 20 millimeters of mercury difference between the alveolar oxygen and the arterial oxygen. So if it's bigger than that. For example, if you have somebody on 100% oxygen and their PO2, if you calculate their alveolar oxygen, it'd be like 700. If their PA, their actual O2 is like 50, well, that's horrible. I mean, it's terribly hypoxemic. So that the higher the FiO2 is and the worse the arterial oxygen is, the more hypoxemic they are and the more grave the clinical situation. Now, this is just the worst case scenario. I'm going to talk about four basic things that cause hypoxemia. And one of the most severe ones we have is this. This is shunt, where there's blood that goes into the lung, traverses through the lung, and never comes in contact with any oxygenated alveoli. There's all kinds of examples of that. There could be intercardiac shunts, there could be intrapulmonary shunts. The one we deal with most often is people have ARDS, where their lungs are completely filled up with fluid, blood goes into the lung, there's no oxygenated alveoli, and they're hypoxemic. And in fact, their PaO2 is very, very low because they have shunt physiology. This is the worst form of hypoxemia that we have to deal with and the hardest one that we have to deal with. More commonly is what we deal with is people that have low ventilation perfusion, where they have some ventilation to the perfusion, but it's much less than one. And because of that, when the blood goes through the lung, the blood that comes out is hypoxemic. The difference between this and the first case is that when you put somebody with low VQ on 100% oxygen, their PO2 comes back up. Why? Well, it becomes back up because when you put somebody on 100% oxygen, you take the alveolar oxygen from being 100, you know, 102 or 104, whatever, up to 700. And by doing that, you allow, even though there's not much ventilation, you allow the oxygenation in the alveolus to occur, which does not occur with shunt. With shunt, it doesn't make any difference how much oxygen you put them on. It's still going to be lousy. Now, this is a simplistic slide, but there's only really four things you have to look at on this slide. One is that the low FiO2 and hypoventilation, those are diseases that are associated with a hypoxemia, but a normal alveolar arterial oxygen. That is to say that gas exchange, there's nothing wrong with the lung. Their lungs are functioning fine. But in spite of that, they're hypoxemic. Think about that for a second. Let's go down to the low ventilation perfusion and shunt. With low ventilation and perfusion and shunt, when you calculate the alveolar arterial oxygen, it's low. There's something wrong with the lung that's preventing from gas exchange to occur normally. In that situation, the next thing is to say, when you put them on oxygen, does it get better? If you put somebody on low ventilation on 100% oxygen, PO2 is going to come back up because you have such a high alveolar oxygen. If you have people with shunt, doesn't make any difference how high the alveolar oxygen is. There's no ventilation of the lung, and they're going to remain hypoxemic. The other two, low FiO2 is asphyxia, where a kid goes closed in an environment, they keep rebreathing their own oxygen, they consume all the oxygen in the environment, and their oxygen is low. Also, in people that are on top of Mount Everest, if people are on top of Mount Everest, the barometric pressure is very low, and because of that, they're going to be hypoxemic. Not because there's anything wrong with the lung, but because there's not much oxygen in the alveolus. And in both of those situations, or that situation, when you put the person on oxygen, the PO2 is going to come back up again. The arterial oxygen is going to come back up. Hypoventilation is the easiest. Hypoventilation is defined by people that are retaining CO2. As the alveolar CO2 goes up, it displaces oxygen from the alveolus and they're good hypoxemic. Again, when you put that person on oxygen, alveolar oxygen, arterial oxygen is going to come back up again. So let's talk just for a second about hypercapnia. Hypercapnia is easier. In people that have hypercapnia, this is just an equation that shows the PaCO2 is equal to a proportionality constant. It's directly proportional to the amount of CO2 that we produce. It's indirectly proportional to the alveolar oxygen. so that if you are producing more CO2, theoretically, you would retain more, your arterial CO2 go up. Why doesn't it? For example, if you're exercising, your CO2 production goes up. If you get a fever, your CO2 production goes up. Does your arterial CO2 go up? No. The reason it doesn't go up is because we increase our minute ventilation to blow off that CO2, so that if we can increase our minute ventilation, CO2 production does not cause increase in our CO2 in the blood. On the other hand, if you have somebody that's on a ventilator and they're paralyzed, we take away their ability to increase their minute ventilation, the arterial CO2 will go up. Obviously, alveolar ventilation is the major thing with this. People that have COPD, why do they retain CO2? What happens to their alveolar ventilation? Goes down, right? Why does it go down? Because they destroy their lungs. They have increased dead space, so that in order to blow off their CO2, normally they would have to breathe 5 liters per minute. COPDers have to breathe 10 liters per minute in order to blow off that CO2. So that increase in dead space and the decrease in alveolar ventilation is the major thing that causes their problems. So we talked about CO2 production. The other three here, disturbance in the gas exchange is the lungs. COPD, all the things that we see every day that cause us to retain CO2. Abnormalities of the mechanical system, the bellows. Something's wrong with the chest wall. We have kyphoscoliosis, we have thoracoplasty, we have some deformity, we have broken ribs or flailed chest, and we retain CO2 because the chest wall can't maintain ventilation. And finally, changes in ventilatory control. This is one of the most common things that we see. People take a medication, narcotic analgesics, benzodiazepines, that suppress respiration and cause our arterial CO2 to rise. Now, the next classification that's pretty easy here is white lung versus black lung. White lung basically is things that cause low ventilation perfusion. Pneumonia, pulmonary edema, atelectasis, interstitial disease we'll talk about later this morning. These are diseases that cause the person to be hypoxemic either at rest or with exercise. On the other side is black lung. Asthma, emphysema, pulmonary embolism, which is kind of a red herring, but the microatelectasis, shunt, and ventilatory failure, all are things that cause hypercapnia. And we'll talk more about that in a second. Now, this is just a person who's got a right middle lobe pneumonia. They've lost the right heart border. So this is the silhouette sign. So this is a person that would be hypoxemic. This is just, actually there's some atelectasis there too. This is atelectasis of the right upper lobe. You know it's atelectatic because the trachea is deviated over, the horizontal fissure is elevated, the right hemi diaphragm is elevated. So this is not just pneumonia, this is somebody that has atelectasis. This is somebody that has ARDS, this could be from anything, trauma, sepsis, whatever you want to pick. But dense bilateral mixed interstitial alveolar infiltrates, you put this person on 100% oxygen, your PO2 is like 50. So this is the kind of the worst case scenario. It's also an example of intrapulmonary shunting. This is miliary tuberculosis, but it could be anything. This is a person that has pulmonary fibrosis. How do you know it's fibrotic? What's different about that than the pneumonia? What's the volume in the lungs? Are the lungs normal volume? No. If you look at the right lung is significantly less volume than the left lung. And that when you see that, something causes volume loss. We said atelectasis, we have endobronchial obstruction, but also if you have scarring of the lung, it increases elastic recoil and the lungs physically get smaller. This is just pulmonary edema, more white lung. This is just that pleural effusion. Now, this is black lung, and this is the worst case black lung. This is somebody that has hyperinflation. The lungs, instead of looking smaller, look bigger. And this is somebody that has alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. For boards, it's fair game. This is something that they could easy. When you look at this x-ray, you look at the basilar portions of the lung, and they're hyperinflated. You have emphysematous changes mostly in the lower lobes. Emphysema classically from smoking, central lobular emphysema, causes upper lobe emphysema. So this would be a fair game for boards. This is just classic emphysema where they have the upper lobe emphysema, diaphragms are decreased, the heart looks like a P. So it's a classic emphysema. Look at a lateral, increase in the AP diameter, increase in the retrosternal airspace. The diaphragms are completely flattened. This is just pneumothorax, not a diagnostic challenge. All right, now, I just want to spend 1 minute on this and then we'll move on. We said that respiratory failure is essentially a cellular event. It's something that happens at the cell level. And the first two, ventilatory failure causes hypercapnia, failure of oxygenation causes hypoxemia. But the other two things are important. You can have failure of oxygen delivery. That is to say, anything that causes your body not to be able to deliver oxygen to the tissues, even if the lungs are normal, can cause them to have tissues, lactic acidosis, and cell death, et cetera. A common example that any shock state, pick any shock state you want, as the cardiac output goes down, septic shock doesn't fit, but the most of the other shock states, when you have shock, your cardiac output goes down, you deliver less oxygen to the tissues, and they get lactic acidosis. How do we know that? And also, if they're profound anemia, carbon monoxide poisoning, anything that decreases your ability to carry oxygen will cause that to happen as well. If you're up in the intensive care unit, we have a Swan-Ganz catheter, and we can measure your mixed venous oxygen tension. In somebody that has the failure of oxygen delivery, the mixed venous oxygen tension goes down. Why does it go down? What happens when you decrease the oxygen delivery to the tissues? The tissues extract more oxygen. They extract more oxygen from the tissues. And because of that, we can differentiate that up in the intensive care unit by looking at the mixed venous oxygen. The final one is failure of oxygen utilization. They're not hypoxemic, they're not hypercapnic, their cardiac output is fine, but they're still having a lactic acidosis. Why? If there's something wrong with the tissues, where the tissues can't extract oxygen, the cells will get lactic acidosis, et cetera. Examples of that would be the obvious one, cyanide poisoning, where you have all the oxygen in the world and they can't extract it. More commonly, septic shock. Septic shock causes you to not be able to extract oxygen properly, and you get lactic acidosis. All right. Now, I'm going to say a couple of words about mechanical ventilation, which I'm not sure how much they would actually test you on this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But this is Marty Tobin's slide from 1994, and it's just as good now as it was. When we put somebody on a ventilator, what are we trying to do? Number one, we want to make their oxygen better. We want to blow their CO2 down. But number two, we want to relieve the respiratory distress. That is, when you go into respiratory failure, Your respiratory muscles have to do a lot more work. The work of breathing can go up by 2, 3, 4, 5 times. And because of that, when you put somebody on a ventilator, you take away that work of breathing and make it easier for them to survive. The last two things here is that we used to think when you put somebody on a ventilator, no harm, no foul. You put them on a ventilator, it's a passive process, you get them off the ventilator, they're fine. We now know that if you use the ventilator improperly, you can cause damage to the lung, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm not going to talk much about this. The CPAP is basically, we use it for sleep apnea. BiPAP, we use for sleep apnea and also respiratory failure. The new kid on the block is AVAPS, average volume assured pressure support. And in my lifetime, your lifetime too, the AVAPS is going to replace BiPAP. It's going to be a way of supplying non-invasive ventilation to people through a mask that guarantees they're going to get the lung volume that we want and the minute ventilation that we want. So that, for you guys, that's going to be the future. When you see somebody ordering AVAPS, they're replacing BiPAP, and you're going to see it in the hospital all the time. Barotrauma, when I was in school, we used to talk about barotrauma. And barotrauma was the notion that when you put somebody on a ventilator, the pressure inside the lung would cause damage to the lung. And in point of fact, that's not right at all. And the reason it's not right is that when you have a high airway pressure on the ventilator, that pressure is measured up by the mouth. It has nothing to do with what's happened in the distal lung. And because of that, if the resistance of the airway is high, the proximal airway pressure can be high. The distal airway pressure, which is going to damage the lung, can be normal. So that just looking at that pressure, that peak airway pressure, is not a reliable measurement of somebody's potential for damage. And just forget that. But they've done experiments in animals where they did exactly that. They put the animals on exactly the same pressure, usually high pressures. And in some of the animals, they let the lungs expand to whatever volume they went up to. In the other animals, they banded the lungs so the lungs couldn't overinflate. And what they found was a simple thing, is that when the lungs are banded and you don't let the lung overexpand, the lungs aren't damaged. On the other hand, if you don't unband the lungs, the lungs expand, they get overstretched and they damage the lung, and they end up with, you know, what's called, we call it volume trauma now. So that it's not pressure that causes damaged lung, it's that alveolar overdistension. So how do we know if somebody has alveolar overdistension? We do a measurement, it's called the plateau pressure. And the plateau pressure is you put the airway pressure into the lung, it measures the peak air pressure that goes in, and at the end of inhalation, you block the air from coming out of the lung. And that pressure is called the plateau pressure. That's what they're showing you. I don't know if I can show you. No, I can't. But it's that P2 that they're showing you here, that's the plateau pressure. And the peak pressure is the peak pressure. The P2 is the important pressure because that tells you if the lung is overinflated. And when people are on the ventilator, that's what we look at. We look at their P2, the plateau pressure. If that number's high, then we take big strategies to try and protect the lung for further damage. This is important, is that when I was training, we used to, when people have ARDS, we would put them on 10, 15 kilograms of cc's per kilogram of body weight. And what we found out is by doing that, you overdistend the lung and you cause damage. In fact, in the old days when people have ARDS, we used to cause further damage to the lung by using too excessive lung volumes. Nowadays, we use smaller lung volumes. We look 5 cc's per kilogram of ideal body weight. We make sure the peak pressure is not too high. And we keep that plateau pressure less than 30. If that plateau pressure is less than 30, there's very little chance that we're going to cause any damage to the lung. AutoPEEP, I'll just measure a couple of things about AutoPEEP because we're running out of time. We said that applied PEEP is something we deliberately set. We create an expiratory resistance, we prevent the airway pressure from coming back to zero, and by doing that, we can have all kinds of good things. We can recruit lung volume, we prevent airway closure, we do all kinds of good things. AutoPEEP is something that occurs inadvertently. We don't create it deliberately, we create it because we don't put the right settings on the ventilator. So how do we do that? Well, one of the main reasons we do that is that we give people high minute ventilations. Everybody in respiratory failure has a high minute ventilation. And the worse the respiratory failure is, the higher the minute ventilation goes. And because of that, many patients have very high minute ventilations. There's less time for the air to get out of the lungs, and they create AutoPEEP and they cause damage. So we try to do things to try and prevent that excessive minute ventilation. And this is what we do. How do you get rid of AutoPEEP? This is the types of AutoPEEP: dynamic airway closure with COPD, high minute ventilation, high resistances in the expiratory circuitry, and then people that are exhaling during exhalation or during the ventilation. How do we identify AutoPEEP when it's present? Well, it's easy. You look at the expiratory flow signal. This is inspiratory pressures at the top, expiratory pressures on the bottom. And what the arrow is showing you is that at the end of exhalation, flow should be zero. There should be no flow coming out of the lung. When people have AutoPEEP, there's still flow coming out of the lung at the end of exhalation. When you see that, it tells you that they have AutoPEEP. In order to identify AutoPEEP, we do a different maneuver. We said that plateau pressures are measured at the end of inhalation. AutoPEEP is measured at the end of exhalation. At the end of exhalation, you block the lung so the lung equilibrates with the manometer, and you measure the pressure that's still in the alveoli at the end of exhalation. And what they're showing you here is that on the right-hand side of the slide, the AutoPEEP pressure is the pressure that comes up when you block at the end of exhalation, and then you can measure it. How do we get rid of AutoPEEP? It's simple. The routine mechanisms, this is adverse effects, forget that. All right. How do we get rid of AutoPEEP when it's present? It's easy. One, we want to increase the amount of time that's available for exhalation. So if we decrease the minute ventilation, We're going to allow more time for exhalation. What's the consequence of that? Say again. Yeah, they're going to get hypercapnia. Exactly right. So that, and so we, it's called permissive hypercapnia. We let them retain CO2 in order to get their pressures down so we don't damage the lung. If they have a wheezing, the wheezing tubes and that kind of stuff. But the major thing, you want to decrease their ventilation. You want to decrease the tidal volume, decrease the respiratory rate. Ours, I'll just mention briefly. The new definition for ours, the Berlin definition, is that it's divided into three categories, mild, moderate, severe. Mild is people that have an arterial to FiO2 ratio of between 200 and 300. Severe is the ratio is less than 100. And the reason that's important is that as that ratio goes down, mortality goes up. So that the more severely damaged the lungs are, the more oxygen it's going to take for the person to be oxygenated, and the worse the mortality is. So get that. Now, I'm going to talk specifically about spirometry in a couple of minutes, so I'll just kind of go over it quickly. When you do spirometry, there's a few things you can look at. The most common one, or classic one, is called the volume time curve. Person takes a deep breath in, they blow the air out. The total amount of air that they blow out is the vital capacity. The amount of air that they blow out in 1 second is going to be the FE1. You would think, excuse me, if the FE1 is low, that the person has airway obstruction. Is that true? Say no. Thank you. If your lungs are obstructed, your FE1 is going to be low. What if your lungs are restricted? They're just smaller than they should be. What's going to happen to your predicted FE1? It's going to be lower. So having a low FE1 does not guarantee that you have an obstructive or a restrictive defect. You have to have a test that helps you with that. The volume time curve here shows, how am I doing? I got 40 seconds, that's fine. When you do a volume time curve, the obstructed pattern, you never plateau. The airway just never goes up and gets all the air out. It just keeps going up. That's an obstructive pattern. Even if you had no numbers on the patient, when you saw that, you would say they were obstructed. On the other hand, the tan line here is showing a normal person that they go up and they plateau normally. People that have restrictive lung disease, where the lungs are smaller, they plateau as well. They don't keep going up the way obstruction does, but the vital capacity is lower than it should be. Now, this is probably the most important slide. No, maybe actually stop on that. How do you differentiate whether somebody's FE1 is low because they have obstruction or restriction? And this is fundamentally important. If you look, somebody has restrictive lung disease, the vital capacity is going to be low, the FE1 is going to be low because the lungs are smaller. But if you take the ratio between the FE1 and the FEC, that's going to be normal. It tells you that the FE1 is low because the lungs are small, okay? On the other hand, if people have obstructed lung disease, they're going to have a normal vital capacity, usually a reduced FE1, but when you take that ratio between the FE1 and the FEC, it's going to be lower than it should be. And that's really all you have to know. And I'm going to talk more about this in a few minutes. These you can just review. It's just look at the flow volume loops. There's some, when they first started, there was a guy, Hutchinson, in the 1700s, that he was a surgeon, actually, and he invented the rolling seal spirometer. It's what we used for centuries for judging lung volumes. And when we did that, we did the volume time curve. We measured volume over time, and we had a volume time curve. More recently, we used what are called pneumatachographs that measure the flow in and out of the lung. We integrate that signal to get the volume, and we get a flow volume loop. The flow volume loops gives you information that you can't get by looking at the volume time curve. And these are just the airway collapse that you have with the emphysema. This is somebody that has upper airway obstruction from a tracheostomy. And this is called a variable extrathoracic obstruction, where if you look at exhalation on the top, it looks relatively normal. But when you look at inspiration, it looks relatively flattened. That means the obstruction is outside the chest. It's in the neck. The next one is a variable intrathoracic obstruction, where when they exhale, the obstruction gets worse and inspiration looks relatively normal. This is typical of anything that's obstructed in the chest, the emphysema, et cetera. Expiration is going to look flat, and inspiration is going to look normal. The last one is a fixed obstruction. A fixed obstruction means is that it doesn't make any difference whether the person's breathing in or out. The obstruction stays exactly the same. If somebody had a tracheal tumor, and the tumor's like a pinhole, it didn't make any difference whether they breathe in or breathe out, the hole stays the same size, that's going to cause that fixed intrathoracic obstruction.